He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
No! Bad lawyer! I need a loophole!
He's not Judge Judy, an executioner!
He is!
Sorry, but my mother always said if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
Will that hold up in court?
No, I've tried it before.
Stop. Ask a question a lawyer would ask, please.
I am a lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 391. I'm Thomas, that's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm just so excited because we obviously did the live Q&A yesterday.
Yeah.
It was great. Everyone was
it
fantastic.
It always is.
I don't know why I'm bringing it up. any announcements this time? I guess not.
No, I think we're good on announcements. We can get right into the meat.
Still plugging away on our amicus briefs.
Indeed, we are.
Just working so hard. I had to dot a couple I's. You know, I also had to, you know, check a couple cases, just, you know, be able to cite them properly. I had to distinguish one of mine. So are these all?
That's 100% plausible. Yes.
Still working. I'm typing it out. Still working hard. Okay. Let's get to the episode. We are going to talk about, I'm so glad we're going to address this. The insider trading probe. What is going on? That will be our first segment. I've got questions. And then also, Republicans want us to have to die in order to vote, I think is the proper.
Yeah, that is the right way to put it.
For the main segment. So here we go. Gee, Zachary Truwelliger, what a clown horn of a week. Yeah, so Andrew, we just had the FBI raids, the guy, you know, took the guy's cell phone and all that. And then I just saw the headlines that were like, well, they dropped the probe on. So they dropped the probe on some of the senators, but not against Burr. Give us the update. What's going on? Who's a criminal? Who's not? What do we make of this?
Well, they're likely all criminals, but, okay. You know, some of this falls into the category of there aren't laws for the kinds of crimes that these are. And let me be clear, because I am not courting any defamation lawsuits from any of these members of the U.S. Senate. So the gravamen of the allegations is that each of these four senators, and those four senators are Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, and probably the second most hard hit from these allegations, James Inhofe from Oklahoma and Richard Burr from North Carolina, had access in some way to information that was not otherwise available to the U.S. public, that the coronavirus was going to be super duper bad. And all four, either on their own behalf or through intermediaries and through family members, sold off a bunch of stock right before the stock market went in the toilet thanks to the coronavirus. This, by the way, let me say, in general, it's very, very difficult to prove insider trading on these kinds of facts, but that these are not the kind of things that go without consequence in the private sector, right? So, for example, one of the reasons why Ray Kasser was fired, he was the CEO at Atari back when Atari was owned by Warner Communications in the early 1980s. In December of 1983, Atari was not going to hit its sales targets. Atari had been like a hugely growing company year over year. And 20 minutes before publicly announcing that, Ray Kasser sold off a bunch of his Atari stock. And look, he was arrested and charged. Ultimately, I think there was a non-prosecution agreement. I know he was not convicted of insider trading, but like he was fired as CEO of Atari, and rightfully so, right?
I'm sure you're going to get to this, but like if he had done that, you know, 1 second into the announcement or something, you know, like, can you still kind of get in early enough?
But
the information's going public.
So, that's not a crazy corner of case, right? Like that question of when is information sort of sufficiently public and baked into the share price is at the core of disputes over what counts as insider trading. Yeah. And it's part of the reason why it's really, really hard to bring insider trading cases. I will tell you, I read some of these in law school, but there is a group in the literature that says we ought to allow insider trading, right? That basically makes the argument that you make. And what it says is, right, if informed insiders are buying up stock, then that is actionable information in the market. And so even if we don't know what they know, like we know some of what they know. And so that's going to then better reflect.
It seems kind of self-serving. Like, we'll get the information eventually once we profit first.
Right. Yeah. No, it is a law and econ theory, right, that is unconcerned with the obviously unfair distributive effects of that rule, right?
But, I'm sure I'm jumping the gun, but shouldn't they just not be allowed to do, like, okay, I get that you have, you know, stock is a form of payment and it's like incentive that way, you know, if it performs well, the stock goes up, it's part of the payment package. Fine, that I get. But couldn't there easily be regulation saying if stock is part of your payment for, say, being the CEO of Atari or whatever it is, you can't sell it. Like you just have to have it, like sit on it the whole time you're there and then maybe after. I don't know.
It would be trivially easy to do that. It would be trivially easy to do what my profession does, right, which is it's not hard to imagine how lawyers could have inside information, right? Yeah. Like I represented Microsoft, right? Like I was aware when Microsoft was about to engage in a major settlement that was going to affect their stock price.
I thought you knew they were going to do Vista before they did it. Yeah. And they just dumped all that stuff.
I did not have any advanced knowledge of
that one.
I think that was Vista. And Windows Me, that was a piece of crap too. But look, like, right, it's not hard to imagine. I'm a lawyer. I represent a company. I know that company is about to enter into a settlement, admit liability, right? Like there's tons of inside information that I could potentially have that would affect the stock price. And the law is just super clear that I can't trade in that, right? Like I have to publicly disclose anything, any individual stock purchase over $10,000, right? And I guess the theory below is like, all right, like we're not even going to waste
$9,999 of profit you could get, I guess.
I suppose, but I've declined to do so, and I no longer represent any publicly traded companies, so you know, so much for that. But right, like it's really, really easy to draw a bright line, and people who are in restricted industries that are not in the financial sector tend to say like, oh yeah, sure, like obviously that should be the case, right? And obviously it should be the case that if you're a sitting member of Congress, that like everything should have to be in a blind trust. You should not be allowed to make individual trading decisions. Like that's no-brainer.
Some senator from Massachusetts who should be president had introduced this very idea.
This exact bill word for word? Yeah, that'd be neat. So, okay, so those are the allegations. Today, the DOJ dropped its inquiry into Feinstein, Loeffler, and Inhofe. All three of those had the excuse, however bad, of we were working through intermediary. I wasn't the one that traded on inside. Like, you know, Loeffler's case, it was her husband who mostly sold most of it. And in Feinstein and Inhofe's case, it was, you know, wealth managers and you know, people, investment managers, right? And so, you know, Feinstein said, oh, I definitely did not tell my investment guy to sell off everything 20 minutes before, you know, coronavirus wiped out a third of the nation's wealth. I don't think that's a super great argument, but again, that's kind of where we are with respect to insider trading, and it's a really good reason why we should beef up our insider trading laws. Now, that leaves Richard Burr, who it is the case, as you pointed out in the introduction, the FBI has executed a search warrant for his cell phone. And let's describe what that means, right? In order to persuade a judge to issue a search warrant, that judge must be persuaded that you have probable cause to believe that the cell phone is an instrumentality of a crime that has been committed. Okay. So, like, you know, we've talked about that before. I think most people know that who listen to the show, but like, right, the classic, you know, TV show, you know, you don't want me to have to come back with a warrant. That's because getting a search warrant requires you to prove to a judge that you have probable cause to think that somebody committed a crime and that they committed a crime, that evidence of the instrumentality of the crime is available with the stuff that you intend to search and seize. So that's pretty high level. There are two ways to view this, right? If George W. Bush were president, right, then the obvious face level objective way to view it is that the DOJ is proceeding with the investigation of the person who traded in his own name. And it was a lot of money. It was $1.7 million, right? And decided not to go after the people who had the, like, intermediary excuse, right? Loeffler, Feinstein, Inhofe. That's very plausible, right? That is the way in which, if this were 2016 opening arguments, case closed, right? Because it is 2020 opening arguments, it must be pointed out that Richard Burr is the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and that as a result of these investigations, he has stepped down from his position as chair. He has not resigned his Senate seat yet, and has been replaced with whiny, do-nothing lapdog Marco Rubio. By the way, Marco Rubio, still not interested in doing his job, right? You might recall it was one of the attacks.
Yeah, he never votes, right? He doesn't do anything.
One of the attacks by Donald Trump, one of the only true things that Donald Trump said in the 2016 primary was that Marco Rubio had the lowest attendance rating of anyone in the Senate. I'm not kidding. It's one of the few things where you can go to PolitiFact and see, oh, Donald Trump said a thing that was true by accident.
I know people are going to hate me for this, but during those Republican debates, one of the reasons he was so effective is that he did actually say some true things about his Republican rivals, about about the Iraq War, about, like, he did actually say some true things about Republicans,
especially about how small Marco Rubio is. I want to tell you, look, and Rubio's argument at the time was like, dude, I'm running for president. Of course, I'm missing a lot of votes. But the response back was, you miss a lot of votes, even for people who run for president, and even when you're not running for president. And in fact, I'll link it in the show notes. If you go to govtrack.us, from January 2011 to May 2020, Rubio missed 292 of 2,774 roll call votes, which is 10.5%. And again, here I'm quoting from a government oversight agency, quote, "This is much worse than the median of 1.7% among the lifetime records of senators currently serving," end of quote. So, look, I long ago picked Richard Burr as the pivotal figure high atop Yodel Mountain. Here is somebody who was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and was not obviously a Trump lackey. And now the Senate Intelligence Committee is chaired by somebody who is equal parts lazy, stupid, and cowed by Donald Trump. And the Senate has real work to do in terms of, you know, conducting inquiries into foreign efforts to shape the 2020 election. And this happens to take somebody who, again, not a Trump critic, not somebody who's, you know, didn't vote for impeachment, didn't vote to allow witnesses, but somebody who was at least kind of reasonably intelligent and independent and has replaced them with Marco Rubio. So I don't like going through that, but like with Bill Barr as the head of the DOJ, like I feel like it would be irresponsible not to point out the political consequences of that.
Okay, but going back to, because I don't want to let our people off the hook, like going back to Feinstein and others, how do they just get off by saying they didn't tell their person? Like, first off, what are the odds? You know, how did their money person, you know to do that? Seems curious. And then couldn't the FBI or whoever it is, DOJ, whatever, couldn't they say, well, we want the following records or phones or whatever to see if, in fact, you did or didn't message them or tell them?
And so let's talk about Feinstein directly, right? And I want to say at the outset, if this were my DOJ, I would, on the available facts, I certainly would continue the investigation, right? And I believe that we should have, you know, the whole point of the segment is, I believe we should have more robust insider trading laws. Here's what happened with Feinstein specifically. The FBI requested that she answer questions, which she did, and that she turn over documents, which she did. She did so voluntarily. And her claim is that her husband, who is a super rich investment banker, and he sold off his investments in a biotech company, again, kind of right before coronavirus hit. Feinstein also points out that she disclosed that that transaction was done in her Senate financial forms. And basically what she says is, look, like, hey, I don't tell my husband what to buy and sell. Now, the argument is, right, and particularly there was a recent amendment in 2012 which explicitly prohibits lawmakers and their congressional aides from using insider information, that is information gained being a member of the U.S. Senate, from buying and selling stocks. So here's the argument either way, right? The argument for continuing the investigation is, come on, like you just used your husband as a proxy to buy and sell these stocks, and you obviously told him, hey, yeah, coronavirus is about to hit. Maybe you don't want to have like a small biotech company that's about to go bankrupt. And again, the lack of, right, like those are perfectly reasonable inferences to make, like whether you have, you know, evidence or not. Like, I don't know, you know, like if you're Feinstein, like how do you disprove that inference? Like, I'm going to turn over the zero emails, right? Well, like, great. But like, you know, are you telling me you didn't see your husband at any point? Like, you didn't sit down and have dinner together? Like, you know, come on. The second half of that is, in exercising prosecutorial discretion, how do you make a case that the husband was a sock puppet, you know, for the wife? And again, you know, this is the Feinstein case and the Loeffler case overlap in that way, in that both have kind of pointed the finger at their respective spouses and said, you know, look, I didn't do this. You know, they did it. And I think that stinks. But if you want a legal distinction between Feinstein and the others and Burr, that's the distinction. The distinction is, do you have a potentially exonerating intermediary that says, I do not come within the 2012 amendments because the lawmaker did not buy or sell stocks, either individually or on their own behalf. Make sense?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. You want somebody to primary Dianne Feinstein? Like, I will donate to that campaign.
I think what bothers me about that, particularly with Dianne Feinstein, is isn't she like 812 years old? Like,
yes,
you still need to insider trade your way to a few more million dollars at the age of 82 or whatever. Like, have some dignity. I don't know.
Yeah. And Feinstein also on the Senate Intelligence Committee, right? Like, I mean, yeah. These are part of that is it is there hits a point where it is. And it's why I think the laws need to be much stronger, where it would be implausible to be a good actor and have an actively trading family member, right? Like, because you're going to come on, like, you're on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Suppose you don't come home and say anything about, like, any specific details at all, right? You don't say coronavirus. You don't say whatever. But, like, you come home, like, I don't know, like, you know, my family knows when I've had a crappy day. And, yeah, like, you know, when you come home from top secret briefing and it's like,
sell all the shares in law.
Yeah. Right. Like, it's kind of hard to hide, you know, at minimum, your overall knowledge of, like, well, is this going to be a good thing or a bad
Andrew's
thing?
Andrew's really grumpy. Sell all the shares in law/Transformers, I guess. Yeah. Maybe sell the Transformers. It's one of those things.
It's definitely one of those two things. Either short the law or short Transformers. But no, so there you go. Like I said, I do not want to embrace the conspiracy theory element. There is a perfectly reasonable justification for proceeding against Burr and not against the others. But I think we would be negligent if we didn't talk about the fact that that legal determination or the ongoing legal investigation into Burr benefited Donald Trump. It took out a reasonable person from the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, Burr is still on the Intelligence Committee, right? And replaced him with a worthless lapdog. So there you go.
Yeah. We need Elizabeth Warren's law to go into effect on this.
Yeah. And we, again, would not be hard, right? Just say that members and define it broadly, right? Like that members of Congress, neither on their own, nor members of their extended family, nor blah, 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 nor blah, 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 right? Like, may not engage in a transaction over $10,000 in any, you know, quarter of any given stock, right? Like, it's super easy. And if they complain, be like, yeah, look, like, I'm sorry, you're going to have to put your stuff in a trust and it's going to have to buy and sell mutual funds while you're in Congress.
You get to be one of 100 senators. Like, is it, or I guess maybe we include the House. But anyway, you get to be in government at a very high level.
Yep.
And, you know, the penalty for that
is you don't get to buy and sell individual stocks.
Yeah,
right?
Take
you
can, what's likely your vast wealth that you already have, most likely, and put it in a different form.
Different investment vehicle, right? Like, again, we're not saying it's got to be coffee cans and mattresses. That's right. It's not confiscatory. Yeah. So, all right.
Okay, well, on to our main segment.
And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen.
And I love all people, rich or rich. But in those particular positions, I just don't want a poor person. Does that make sense?
I won't go any more than that because you're Boy Scouts, so I'm not going to tell you what it is.
America's so true.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills!
All right, on to our main segment. The House Republicans are really mad about not having to risk their lives to vote, right?
That's
just about that.
They are, because again, remember, the game plan for the Republican Party is to complain that government doesn't work and then do everything they can to break it to prove that they were right. So if you oppose, right, and here, like with coronavirus, it's a win-win situation for them, right? Because Democrats are more likely not to show up to cast votes if you have 435 people milling around licking each other, which is what they do during normal vote periods. Citation needed on that. But like, seriously, like they're right jammed up against each other. Right? Like it's gross on the floor of the House of Representatives. I know, I've been there. So it's all wins, right? Like Democrats are more likely to be responsible. And so thus, maybe you have a situation where you have a quorum of folks present, but actually a majority of Republicans because Democrats are staying home. That's a real possibility. Republicans are also feeding their infantile and insane QAnon base that says, well, there's no need to social distance and coronavirus is a hoax and also was invented by the Chinese. And don't think about the fact that these two things are contradictory. But like, you know, being against being responsible and saving lives is also part of the far right Republican platform. And then thirdly, right, what I led off with, which was, if what you do to combat those first two is basically say, all right, the House won't be taking any votes, while, you know, we're under, without having a quorum, a majority of representatives present, then they win because the House isn't doing anything. And that is then proof of their argument that the House can't do anything. So what happened? Reason number a billion why it was a celebratory moment and worth building on that the Democrats retook the House in 2018. Democrats retook the House in 2018. Don't know if you heard that, Thomas.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
That's
why we have Trump's tax returns.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, shouldn't rub that one in.
That's fine.
Little did you know, laws don't matter anymore. Nothing.
I kind of thought that maybe they did. So on May 15th, Nancy Pelosi fast-tracked, brought up, and the House voted for H.R. 965, which says at any time after the speaker is notified in consultation with the Senate attending physician, or with the House attending physician. I did not know that was a position, but apparently it is. That a public health emergency due to a novel coronavirus is in effect. Okay, so this is truly a targeted piece of legislation. The speaker, in consultation with the minority leader, may designate a period during which a member who is designated by another member as a proxy may cast a vote for such other member. And so that passed, and that's exactly what happened, right? The implementing resolution is also H.R. 967, which designates that period as being May 19th through July 21st. It's extendable every 45 days. Nancy Pelosi went to Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and said, hey, here's what we're going to do because, you know, coronavirus, we're going to let you, only a handful of people are going to show up from both parties. And you can email somebody who is here to cast votes on your behalf. And it literally is, you can email them, right? And that makes total sense because, as we've said with, you know, churches and podcasts and other business, you know, a business that you can conduct remotely, talking and voting on stuff.
Yeah.
That's super not hard.
Just in case of shenanigans, potential shenanigans. What recourse do you have if someone casts your vote wrong? Like maybe there's a miscommunication. Oh, you voted the wrong way for me.
Yeah, you would have the exact same. That it's a really, really good question. It's already covered by the House rules because sometimes members of the House of Representatives push the wrong button.
Yeah. Right?
Like they already used a little button thingy, and sometimes you push the wrong button, and you just petition to the chair and you say, oh, hey, I pushed the wrong button, and they fix that. And so in every kind of crazy, wacky, far off, you know, you hacked my house email, like then you would just say, oh, yeah, you would show up on the floor of the House and say, hey, that vote that Jamie Raskin cast for me, I wasn't the one that actually emailed him. Or I meant to email him and say vote aye, and he voted nay, and it's all a mess. Fix that, because my vote was really aye. So there's not a problem. There's an easily remediable solution. But nevertheless, the Republican members of the a handful of Republican members of the House of Representatives have sued for injunctive relief in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia to enjoin Nancy Pelosi and the House of Representatives from using proxies to cast votes in the House. I'm gonna tell you a couple of things here. First, I want to say, by the way, these are what are known H.R. 965 and 967 are what are known as simple resolutions, and a simple resolution is a resolution that only affects one branch of Congress, right? So, in other words, when the House of Representatives wants to change its own rules, you don't need to get approval from the Senate. You don't need to get the president to sign it. That's how this was able to pass, right? So this is not like how a bill becomes a law. It's a simple resolution. It's in effect. And then the question is, can Republicans use the court to undo that? And the answer, I'm very confident to tell you, is no. And I want to tell you, it's not necessarily no on the merits, but it's certainly no in this lawsuit. You want to take a guess as to why it's a clear no in this lawsuit?
Because they totally messed up the lawsuit or something, and they're incompetent, or
because it is very clear that the Republican members of Congress in the minority party do not have standing to allege an injury that the courts can
redress.
Because,
like, even if they could vote, no matter how, they wouldn't have been able to change the outcome? It is.
Remember episode 361 when we talked about Blumenthal versus Trump, which was the D.C. Circuit in one of the Emoluments Clause cases.
The
Emoluments Clause case brought by minority Democrats in the House and Senate that said, hey, you deprived us of a vote on whether to approve of letting Donald Trump receive these benefits from foreign countries. And the D.C. Circuit unanimously said this February 2020, it is controlling precedent in the D.C. Circuit, which is the court that sits above the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. So this is a slam dunk, no brainer. Hey, the people who overrule our decisions told us 2 months ago exactly how to interpret this. And what they said was that if you're just a member of Congress, if you're not singled out, you don't have standing to allege an injury that you didn't get to vote on a thing that would have lost anyway. Here's what they said. The members were not singled out. Their alleged injury is shared by the 320 members of Congress that did not join the lawsuit, and their claim is based entirely on the loss of political power. And that is insufficient to bring a lawsuit under now binding settled precedent in the D.C. Circuit, thanks to the DOJ's own briefing in the Emoluments Clause cases. Because, you know, as you recall, like I said, when the Blumenthal case was filed, I said I thought this was the weakest of the three, that there's an argument that there's an argument to be made there for an expansive view of standing. In general, I favor an expansive view of standing. But I am chuckling at watching Republicans getting ready to go down in flames because of the rule that got put into place by their own litigation. So now you gave a deep sigh there. What was that? What was the deep sigh for?
It's unbelievable to me that they want, you know, like why are they even doing this? Like, they're suing over a totally obvious, reasonable thing to do in a pandemic.
Yeah, well, look, let's talk. Yeah, no, you're not. It's worse than that. So, right. So procedurally, they're going to lose. Blumenthal is controlling. That's clear as Kushner. Let's look at the actual lawsuit itself. And again, as usual, we're going to work backwards. Right. So the lawsuit has three counts. It is a declaratory judgment and injunctive relief. Right. And count three is that the speaker has violated, quote, the structure of the U.S. Constitution, end of quote. That's the nonsense.
Vibe of it, the vibe of the thing.
If those words were in a lawsuit brought by a Democrat, like, they would be front page news on every Fox News site, you know, for a week, making fun of them. Right. But, you know, when Republicans allege it, I guess it's fine. It actually is. Count three, violation of the structure of the U.S. Constitution by authorizing proxy voting and counting members absent towards establishing a quorum. H.R. 965 contravenes the founders' design, subverts the structure of the United States Constitution, and is invalid. That's not a thing, right? Yeah. Subverting the structure of the Constitution is not a valid claim or cause of action. Okay, so that's garbage. What about count two? Count two is violation of the yeas and nays requirement of Article 1, Section 5.
You didn't let me say, I really like saying yay and nay. Like, I like being there and saying it.
If the argument is maybe a little better than that, but not much. So Article 1, Section 5, Clause 3 states, each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the same, excepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy. And then here's the critical part. And the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any question shall, at the desire of one-fifth of those present, be entered on the journal. And then the argument is that requires that the recorded vote be cast by members who are actually present in the chamber, that is, physically there. And so since you can now get one-fifth for a division by email and proxy, you're not actually present, so you're violating that provision of the Constitution. Leaving aside the definition of the word present, which we're going to get to in a second, this is also not a great argument. And the reason it's not a great argument is because Article 1, Section 5, Clause 3 is about the internal rules of the House. Right. It's about what the House shall do. It's right. It's got to keep a journal. It's got to make it public. And the journal will report those public if, you know, enough members of Congress want it to do so. As you might imagine, the case law is crystal clear that the courts are to defer to the House when it comes to making your own rules. Right. Because as long as you're in compliance with kind of the overall vibe of the thing, right? As long as you're actually keeping the record of votes, like how you figure out when those votes are public, like courts are like, yeah, you know what? That's not an injury to the public or to the other members of the House. And like that, just figure that out, right? We don't want a part of it. We will defer to you on that. Make sense? And then reading backwards, that takes us to count one. And this is the best argument, but still not a good argument. It is violation of the quorum requirement of Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution. So same section, but the first clause says, each house shall be a judge of the elections, returns, qualifications of its own members, and a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business. And so what that says is, and then the clause continues, a smaller number may adjourn from day to day and may be authorized to compel the attendance of absent members in such manner and under such penalties as each house as may provide. And so the argument is, and here I guess I also need to go back and get the history point. This comes from page 21. It's paragraph 71, that the Constitution uses unambiguous words like meeting, assemble, attendance, present, absent, recess, sitting, and seat. And those all mean physically being in the same room. And I think that's kind of crazy in the sense that I know all of us now have said, I've attended a meeting, right? Like I've got a meeting when we finish this record, right? And it's a meeting over Zoom in which people will be present, even though none of us are in the same room, right?
People will be Transformers toy devotees. And Andrew has a very important meeting with them, right?
Yeah, a client meeting, but close.
Right? Oh, okay.
And again, right, this is this is one of these, this is almost self-parody, right? Like one of the arguments we emphasize all the time in terms of turning back originalism is, look, give originalism a little bit more credit than like the Second Amendment means you have a right to own a musket, right? Like the Second Amendment protects, you know, the right to own certain kinds of firearms in certain kinds of conditions. But don't make the bad argument that it only means firearms as then extant in 1791, because then the First Amendment would only apply to, you know, newspapers as then extant in 1791.
Right. I do agree, but isn't there, and sorry to derail your
No.
But there is some argument to, like, if you're interested in founders' intentions, which is a big if, there's a big difference in how they would have thought of weapons given their relatively worthless firepower.
That's exactly right. That's the distinction, right? And so that's why, for example, you can have the First Amendment saying Congress shall make no law restricting the freedom of the press, right? And when Congress passed laws about what you could say on public television, right, they drew a distinction between, like, oh, okay, that there's a difference between something that is, you know, a newspaper that you have to actually go and affirmatively pick up, and the public airway, and everybody can start their own newspaper. And so if you don't like it, you can versus, you know, we only got three TV channels, and, you know, that we're going to exercise control over those three channels. And those arguments, whether persuasive or not, like, were parsed in exactly the way that you've described, right? Which is, hey, is a TV station more like a newspaper or more like something else, right? And again, I think some of this was wrong in the 1950s, but the court said, yeah, that's right. The founding fathers didn't know what a TV was. The principles that they described for a newspaper would apply in things where the space is unlimited, but it wouldn't apply in areas where the space is limited. And that's why you have far greater protections for stuff that, you know, far fewer restrictions for stuff that's said on the internet versus stuff that's said on TV even today. It's that basis of that, like those 1950s era cases in talking about, is it limited or unlimited? So your point is correct, right? You could certainly say, let's take a look at firearms and go, is this firearm more like the principle that the founding fathers were thinking about, mm-hmm. or more like something else? And that's exactly what you would do. I love that question. That's exactly what you would do with words like meeting, assemble, attendance, present, absent. You would ask, like, what was that meant to say, right? It was meant to say, look, people have got to get together, right? What we didn't want to have happen was we didn't want to have, like, the House of Representatives, like the states surrounding Pennsylvania and then later the District of Columbia. Like, we didn't want Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia to be like, okay, we're convening, quickly kind of race there on their horses, be like, all right, well, we're here, time to get a whole bunch of business done before those yahoos from South Carolina, Florida, you know, Maine, Rhode Island, before they get here on horse, right? Like, the idea was, we want people physically to be present so that everybody has an opportunity to participate, and that's what the quorum requirement was meant to protect. You would then, and if you look at the case law, like, shockingly, this notion of, like, can you be present for a quorum without being physically present, gets litigated. It hasn't been litigated with respect to Congress, but gets litigated with respect to businesses and institutions and government agencies all the time. And you will not be surprised that, generally speaking, if the case is from 1950, they probably held that to be a quorum, you got to be there, right? Like, that's what the business world was like, right? Like, you would have a phone call to let someone know you were coming, but the phone call was not how the business got done. The business got done in person. Shockingly, if you have a case from 2010 or later, almost all of those cases go the other way, right? They're like, look, yeah, heck, you can have a quorum over the phone. You can have a quorum on a video conference. I'm like, yeah, that is, what are we? What is this, 1950? And if you think about, you know, your day-to-day experiences, right? Like I said, I have client meetings almost every day, right? Those are not telephonic meetings. Who cares? I am a member of several different boards. We have a quorum present telephonically every single meeting. That there's the idea that there is this underlying principle to protect is very, very hard to deal with. And you don't have to take my word for it. A nonpartisan report from the Congressional Research Service that I found hilariously because it is cited. It's written by legislative attorney Todd Garvey. It's only 4 pages long, so you know we'll link it in the show notes. You can read it. It's cited. The reason I found it is because it is cited in the House Republican brief. It is cited with italics added for the sentence. The text of the Constitution clearly envisions the House and Senate meeting and voting in person. And then they italicize clearly, and they're like, oh, see, look, Congressional Research Service says that. So that's why I looked it up to track down the sources. Will it shock you to learn that after the paragraph that says the text of the Constitution clearly envisions the House and Senate meeting and voting in person, that the very next paragraph says, but while these provisions may support a conclusion that the framers envisioned a physical meeting of Congress, as it was, of course, the only possible method of meeting at the time, none would appear to clearly bar remote voting.
Yeah.
And that's right. So for example, right, the adjournments clause says that, And so, for example, historically, Congress has passed special rules via a simple resolution, the exact same principle that was used here, allowing the House of Representatives to convene outside of Washington, D.C. So, you know, in other words, like you could have like one of those days where it's like it's beautiful outside. Can we have class outside?
It's like a field trip.
Yeah. So, look, all of that is Congress has broad powers to set its own rules as to what constitutes being present. It gets worse than that for the House Republican. Like, so already, right, like their case is going to get bounced on standing, but their argument is bad in that we've already litigated the question of whether the House can define what constitutes a quorum. And the reason for that was for the first 100 years, quorum counted everybody who was present in the room and voting on the matters before it. But if you voted present, right, if you didn't vote at all, you were not counted as part of the quorum, right? So in other words, right, like you could show up and obstruct business. You could actually physically be there and be like, oh, yeah, we're not going to participate in this, so therefore there's not a quorum. And Speaker Thomas Reed said, that's ridiculous. And again, his stated reason was that encourages obstructionism. It encourages people to show up, but then not vote as a way of not letting us get stuff done. So he rammed through a resolution in 1890 that reinterpreted the House rules that said all members present in the chamber count towards a quorum, whether they vote or not. And so first he did it just by fiat. And then later, the House amended their rules. And as you might imagine, as soon as a law was passed that passed by a majority of members present, but not a majority of them voting, right? So in other words, 50, you know, assume a quorum is 100, right? Mm-hmm. 50 to 40 with 10 non-voting, right? As soon as a law passed under those conditions, folks sued to say that law was not valid because there wasn't actually a quorum present. And by the way, as a sidebar, that's how we get a resolution on this question, right? Like this particular lawsuit, there's no chance that Kevin McCarthy has standing, but it doesn't mean that the courts are powerless to address the question. The way in which you address the question is when a law passes that was voted out of the House with proxy voting, you bring a lawsuit that says that law isn't good law. right, that says that law was ultra vires. It was not passed in accordance with the authority of the Constitution. The reason that Kevin McCarthy wants this lawsuit to prevail is because it's a tougher argument. Once the law is already the law and people are abiding by it, it's tougher to kind of unring the bell, right? Like, yeah. It's a tougher posture. But, like, too bad, right? Like, those are the standing rules, and that's how, right? Like, it wasn't minority members of the House didn't challenge the quorum rules back then. They waited until a bill got passed, and then that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. That was called U.S. v. Ballin. And when the Supreme Court said, within the constitutional restraints, that there is a reasonable relation between the mode or method of proceeding established by the rule and the result which is sought to be attained, all matters of method are open to the determination of the House and beyond the challenge of any other body or tribunal. So what that means is we're not saying non-justiciable. Right. We're not saying that the Supreme Court, that the House of Representatives enacted a rule that said Nancy Pelosi gets to vote on behalf of all of the Democrats, whether they authorize that or not, because, you know, they're all Democrats and they probably will allow it. That would certainly not survive a constitutional challenge. Right. That would not be consistent with the rule. But if the majority of the House of Representatives gets together and says, so as to not become disease-ridden vectors for a pandemic, we're going to send emails like the rest of this country is doing. That strikes me as precisely the kind of situation that U.S. v. Ballin was meant to protect. So I think even on the merits that this argument is bad. But this lawsuit is not going to get there. This lawsuit's going to get bounced on standing.
I just, once again... I know it's hard to put your mind inside the mind of a raccoon trying to ruin our government. But what is the point of this? I don't even understand it from a Republican standpoint. What is the point of it?
Yeah, the point are those three things, right? To make it more like, and think about when we had Christy Clark on the show, right? I think this is actually probably gets at what they are hoping. If the rules require you to be present in person, the Democratic majority is not razor thin in the House, but it's, you know, it's not huge. It's 30 odd votes. Right. And so you might have a day in which 50 Democrats are absent and all the Republicans are there, in which they would then constitute a quorum. They would be authorized to do business. And who knows what kind of mischief and shenanigans they could get up to. There are procedural limits in place, and, you know, you still have a Democratic speaker and it would prevent legislation. But like I wouldn't put it past them. Right. Because Christy Clark told us about how House Republicans in North Carolina in the state legislature were waiting for the day in which any two Democrats were out in order to do exactly that. So I think it is shenanigans, and I think it is obstructionism.
Pointless shenanigans.
Yeah.
It's not even.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so cool.
Glad to know Republicans are doing their part.
Yep.
In this crisis.
Well, look, if you believe government's the problem, maybe you like this. I don't know.
All right. Well, that said, I think it's time to thank our Hall of Famers.
What do you think? I can't wait.
It is time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats, here on Top Patron Tuesday, patreon.com/law. And I'll start us off. Thank you to Backtracks.fm. The Western States Pact is the world's fourth largest economy. This too shall pass. The People's Patron, Comrade Michaels. Comrade Michaels.
The People's Elbow coming in from the top buckle.
TheMulletShirt.com, business in front, party in the back, check us out. DynamiteResumes.com, Mike Hall, Newton, my chill. Dr. Rachel defended her PhD during quarantine. Oh, congrats. Yolam Tam, episode 61's top patron. Don't look into it. Richard Coeur de Liberal, that's liberal, you villain. It's a play on Richard the First, the Plantagenet. Oh, never mind. Samuel Bland, fly like a hot dog, freedom eagle. This episode brought to you by the letter Q for quarantine. Angry Macface, friend of the court with benefits. Penelope Fippin's pernicious production of pomegranates. A string of impeachable characters, each more impeachable than the last. Ben Helquist, Zach Groner, Dexter King Williams, There's No Rule That Says a Watchdog Can't Play Basketball. Robin, Books That Burn podcast co-host Hoffman. This Patreon name is a lot more pressure than I was expecting. In Illinois, we pronounce it Illinois. Biggest Dickus, follow Silk at appearslegit.com. There's nothing you can name us that's anything like Mandamus. Chalupa Batman. What? Half Price Plague and Murder Hornet combo, only 2.9 trillion while quantities last. Murray Gregerson, the venerable Richard Milhouse Nixon. Ian Buckley, Kristen Daniel, Jake Braun. Mitch McConnell admitting he's wrong is the most surprising event of 2020. I missed that. He admitted he's wrong about something?
I must have missed that one, too.
It was probably like, oh, I was wrong. I thought Democrats couldn't sink any lower, but now... probably something like that. GiveToModestNeeds.org. GiveToModestNeeds.org. Asylum is legal. End MPP and metering. Christopher Brown. Lawfulcopter, and now Thomas will read the rest of the Patreon names. Not quite right. Can we get cert to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3B answers? Flip the Georgia Senate seats. Vote for John Ossoff. Be a government informer. Betray family and friends. Fabulous prizes to be won. Let me be totally clear, Torres Smith 2024. Conrad's takeover occurred after episode 65. Zirkel. We got so fat during social isolation that we can finally get rid of the Bible Belt. I want more briefs. Brad in Texas. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Andrew Seidel isn't just a great butt haver, but he's also a great law talking guy.
That's Matt Astra. True.
Odin is a truth telling dog faced law dog. Polly Hernandez, Emily Rainbow Spence. Volunteer to caption videos for the deaf at amara.org. AMARA.org.
That is fantastic. You should do that.
Absolutely. Those who would give up essential health to purchase a little temporary haircut deserve neither. Stocking up on lung injectable bleach. Jason Copas. Canada, send all those confiscated automatic rifles to Antifa. They need them. Thanks. Terry Cannon. Hotspear.com grants 6 impossible certs before breakfast. Church of the Legal Beagle. Rugby is a game of laws, not rules. Nate Drex. Is that an extraordinarily large denominator in your pocket, or are you just passing the bar exam? Stuffin Poles, Darth Mandy Pants, Whitey Tidy Amicus Briefs, I'm an Unbrewing, Murder Hornets, or with the right lawyer, Manslaughter Bees, 13th Century Saxony Gravel Truck Lawyer, Save the USPS, they are essential for small businesses, and volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Your turn, Andy.
And thank you to Jennifer Cratch, to Remain Indoors. Diogenes the Cynic was right. Wash your hands, then vote for Joe Biden. Acting IG for State Church Separation and Expert Consensus. Stephen Balticate Sandoval. Death and taxes are seeming more certain these days. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Using Trump's logic about Twitter, Joe Biden should be able to shut down Fox News. This house is going to look clown-horning great when the lockdown is done. Mine is not going in that direction. Yeah, that's right. The Eli Bosnick School of Morality. Hey, our friend Eli Bosnick, hopefully by the time this comes out, will have given birth to his first child. Max
Maybe.
Bosnick.
I don't know.
We don't know. That kid does not want to come out, but yeah, we'll see.
I don't blame the kid. Kid's like, what? Yeah. Why would I leave?
Coronavirus and Trump versus I could just stay up in here? Yeah, I agree. John Bilderback, if you can read this, you're smarter than Jay Sekulow. Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, Seattle, home of Westland Distillery, tons of corgis, and OA live shows. Civil law systems are clearly superior to common law systems. Wow, shots fired. Me fail presidenting, that's impossible. Trump is almost literally the mayor from Jaws. Yeah. Eric Alsman, Absalon, Payne Strumpet, Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney, Andrew's a close second. Fantastic Gus is my favorite squirrel. Frank is a close second. Napoleon, the wandering gambler. You guys really are a bright spot in my week despite constant bad news. Hey, it's not all bad, but thank you. We appreciate that. Milo Meadsong stands in solidarity with UW nurses and their union. Moderately handsome John tried to duck a curveball, now just okay looking. Shout out to your guest appearance on God Awful Movies. That was pretty great. Stay at home. Stay the F at home. Thank you. The only karaoke legend named Oliver Closeoff. Join your labor union. Together we bargain. Alone we beg. Who was that masked man, Captain Everybody? James Call, for all intensive purposes. I like it. No. Chad T. Anonymous. Judge Sullivan, this is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps. Oh, man. Best redubbing ever. Other than freak you, Sam Rothstein. Freak you. WordOrigins.org, now with a new and spiffier look. Adam Costa, perennium member of the taint team. Jay Aldenwalt, closing concessions. Don't stand so close to me, 20. How to make a Tennessean furious in two words, Marsha Blackburn. Yeah, let's hope so. Innocent until proven guilty, Hornets. I like it. Derek, Andrew is my favorite Andrew. Andrew is a close second. The Larry Klayman Law School Law Review and Coloring Book. Big Easy Blasphemy. The Yodeler has achieved escape velocity and now is in orbit. Rhonda wants an Alaskan live show before it all melts. I picked a hell of a pandemic to quit drinking. Malika Chandler, Poot, Quackentush, Soggy Pants, David in Brooklyn, Matthew Vernon, Adopt a Homeless Pet in a Post, Decline in Ear Docking. Don't take legal advice from Laser Beam Monstrosity, Attorney at Law. Sakashite Fukasumi doesn't list a cog disc because I am faint of heart. My heart is very faint. Yeah, we had somebody was a patron over cog disc last week that was like, I'm patronizing cog disc because OA is too depressing. So I guess we could start a podcast feud with them, right? Cecil and Tom, done, we'll put them. Done. Yeah, we'll put them on notice. Heather L., Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Allie, Danny Rosari, again, soon-to-be-proud Papa Eli Bosnick. Our love goes out to you, brother. Sam Danow, Sam Buck, I really want a pinata just for me. I share enough stuff with my kid. Mitchell, Alexandra Chalupa, a.k.a. Natasha Crunchwrap, no commute, so behind on podcast. We'll catch up. NIST has designated one Collins as the smallest measurable amount of concern. That is fantastic. I agree with that 100%. And of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, but apparently was not always there, Conrad Michaels.
Yeah, still not to the bottom of when his reign of terror started. But
yeah, we're trying to get there, so.
We're trying in that we're reading the patron names of people who have looked into it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well,
that's the bare minimum that we could do.
Yeah. T3B, answer time. Let's see if I'm back on the saddle.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
All right, Thomas. This was about... fire that started in a defendant's warehouse spread to the plaintiff's adjacent warehouse. You did, seeking a little caution because of on a modest two question losing streak. You picked one no answer and one yes answer.
Yeah, but highlight the fact that that was more about how boldly I was eliminating C as an answer. Because like, C comes in there strutting its stuff and I was like, oh, the premises under the doctrine of Rylands v. Fletcher. And I could have eliminated both no's, but I feel like it was more bold to be like, well, that's BS.
I love that. I will tell you, Rylands versus Fletcher is a strict liability doctrine left over from 13th century Saxony.
Yeah.
And the modern interpretation is that it is restricted to what we consider abnormally dangerous activities, right? So if you have, you know, a volcano emporium and lava factory, then yes, you're responsible for any release of the lava, whether you're negligent or not.
Gotcha.
But since we don't have that here, right, we just have the old rule, right? Again, 13th century Saxony, the old rule was fire was an abnormally dangerous activity. Because, you know, in 1274, fire was an abnormally dangerous activity. Like, you know, who knew what it caused and how it spread? And, right.
Yeah.
And now
it works.
Right. Yeah. Now, fires happen. Right. And so you were 100% correct to eliminate C.
Elimination.
It was a bold and correct elimination. You also eliminated A, and this is the question, can the plaintiff recover when the fire spreads? You also eliminated A, no, because the statute provides only for criminal penalties. Again, a good elimination. So then you were left choosing between B, there is no evidence that the defendant negligently caused the fire to start. Or D, yes, because the plaintiff was harmed as a result of the defendant's violation of a statute that was meant to protect against this type of occurrence. You went with D, and I'm pleased to tell you, you're back in the saddle again, my friend. Yeah, this is a question about the doctrine of negligence per se, right? And it means the following. When you break a law of which that statute was meant to protect against the kind of harm that happens, and the harm happens, you are negligent per se. You do not need to introduce any other evidence. The principal way in which negligence per se comes into effect is when you're speeding and you run into somebody, right? Like the speed limit's 25 in the neighborhood, you're going 40, you run somebody over. There's no discussion about what other evidence is there that you were failing to abide by the standard of care of a reasonable driver in the area? Mm-hmm. The evidence is you were breaking the law, right?
Yeah.
And so here, the fact that the law says you have to have a sprinkler means that if you don't have a sprinkler, you are negligent per se when a fire starts and spreads to your neighbor's warehouse. So plaintiff doesn't have to do any work, doesn't have to prove that you were negligent. You're negligent per se, because you broke the law. And again, there's that restriction that the harm that you cause has to be the kind of harm that the violation was meant to protect, to stop against corner cases, right? Like where there's literally no connection, like you are incidentally violating another law while something happens, right? Like I don't know that I can even come up with that kind of a hypothetical on the spot, but it's not hard to imagine, right? Like you don't just point at somebody and go, lawbreaker, therefore I win. You point at them and go, they were breaking the law, therefore they were negligent, they caused this harm, and therefore I win. So you got it exactly right. You were not thrown by crazy doctrines, and you got it right for the right reasons. So congratulations.
All right. Nailed it. I'm the winner this week, but who is our audience winner?
Yeah, the second winner.
Tell us.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas, this week's winner is Colbin Erdahl on Twitter, who writes, answer is D. If it was C, you'd never get all those defendants holding a boombox up to the judge, blaring Billy Joel, presumably innocent man. Thomas's bar question analyses are getting better and better. That's 100% true. And by the way, complimenting Thomas, always a good way to make it onto the winner's circle. Hashtag no losing streak. So congratulations, Colbin. Everyone, give them a follow over at C-O-L-B-I-N-E-R-D-A-H-L, Colbin Erdahl on Twitter. And congratulations for being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. We love you, folks. Stay safe out there. And we will see you on Friday.
Yep.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.